Think it's on. Okay, great. I am Phil Smith, and I really appreciate you allowing me to come and talk to you tonight. I normally talk standing up, but if I get tired, I guess I can sit down. Just a little bit about me, if you don't know me. I'm a native Oklahoman, born and raised here. Although, thanks to the military, I did live in California and North Carolina and Arizona a little bit, and spent some extensive time in Western Europe, going back and forth, doing fun things while I was in the United States Army. I'm very proud of being in the Army. It was good to meet a couple of Marines back there. I almost joined the Marines, but decided not to. I don't remember why I decided not to, but anyway, and I'm also proud that when I was in the United States Army, I was a special operations interrogator during the 1980s, and as a result of that, I was lucky enough to get to go to language school for a year, studying the Czech language, which really helped me in my graduate school, because if you know anything about graduate school, you have to have a language and you have to carry out your research in that language. So I was lucky enough to be able to do that. And if I could put in a plug right now, I have a book coming out next year on Czech immigration to Oklahoma, be published by the University of Oklahoma Press. So I'm excited about that. I had a book published last year about Tulsa. It's a historical novel about Tulsa. And I think I brought some last time I was here about a year ago, because it had just come out about a year ago. So I'm the one that's out right now. The one that's out right now is called Then Sings My Soul. It's a Christian historical novel about Tulsa in the 1950s. And the one that's coming out, it's coming out in the fall of 2017. And OU does not like my title, so right now I'm working with the editors. They may change it, but right now the title is From Praha to Prague. It's about the Czech community in Prague, Oklahoma. So it'll be coming out, but that name may change a little bit. I'm a professor at Tulsa Community College. I have been to lots of school. Kind of my relatives used to call me a professional student. I held degrees from Northeastern and from the University of Tulsa, and my PhD from Oklahoma State University. And I like TCC. It's a very fine place to teach. I don't like everything about it, but it's about as good a place as you can be. Plus, it's in my hometown, and so I love being in my hometown. I want to start out. I've got a Bible. I don't know if anyone else does. I'll have to put my glasses on for this. I want to read as our text Genesis chapter 3, and I'm going to read the first five verses. I've got the fifth verse up there for you. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field, which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, Yea, hath God said, Ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden. And the woman said unto the serpent, We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. But of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God hath said, Ye shall not eat of it, neither shall ye touch it, lest ye die. And the serpent said unto the woman, Ye shall not surely die. For God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as gods, knowing good as evil. The two parts of that I really want you to think about is the first one. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field. Subtle meaning clever. And that's what we're faced with today, is a movement which is inspired by Satan. And Satan, being clever, has duped a lot of good people. And as a result, a lot of these good people think that they're going to be like gods, that they're going to bring heaven on earth. And I want to talk about one particular one. There are many. This is a fellow by the name of Herbert Croly. I would not expect very few of you to have heard of him. He was an intellectual. He was born in the late 1800s. To a couple of parents who were journalists. They were irreligious. They were agnostic or atheist, It depends on which book you read about him. So he was raised up in a secular household. He was very bright. He made super grades. He was a straight-A student. He went to college. He himself became a journalist later on. He was one of the ones in the early 1900s that Theodore Roosevelt called a muckraker, if you're familiar with the Progressive Era. Herbert Croly is important because he wrote a book that was published in 1909. Folks, books are important because they disseminate ideas. I could go through a list of books that have changed America. One off the top of my head was written actually in 1906, which we have the Meat Inspection Act and the USDA as a result of it. It was written by a socialist by the name of Upton Sinclair. We had a president read it and fell in love with it, and he immediately started pushing for inspection of meat. Not that that's a bad thing, but it was one book. DDT was banned as a result of one book, although that's, even though that book's been discounted, it doesn't matter. The laws are still there. In the 1950s, there was another book basically saying that 10 to 20% of Americans were homosexuals or had homosexual tendencies. Again, even though that book has been completely debunked, I guarantee it you can find, I know you can because I know one that quotes it in her history class. Herbert Croly wrote a book in 1909 called The Promise of American Life. It was a utopian book about what America could be from a progressive viewpoint. Croly was one of the leaders of the progressive movement at the turn of the century. Three presidents read this and fell in love with the book. They were Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, and Franklin Roosevelt. All three of them talked about it extensively during their campaigns and after they became president, that they felt that that could be the future of America. Not only that, but Croly also started a magazine, an academic journal called The New Republic. The New Republic is still around today. You can find it on the internet. Used to it was in hard copy. I don't know if it's still in hard copy anymore. But he was its creator and its first editor. It became the Flagstaff magazine for the progressive movement. Now, later on, there was another journal that was started called The Nation. It is also still around today. Those are probably the two, you might call them the gold standard of progressive thought. So let's look at who were the original progressives. And I'm going to make a statement, and I will stand by it. A lot of them were good people. A lot of progressives today are good people as far as their what they want. I mean, they're not evil people with horns and a tail running around. And that's, again, that's Satan. That's the cleverness. That's how he's got them duped. And a lot of times they dupe people, including Bible-believing Christians. Mm-hmm. I know some Bible-believing Christians that fall for this stuff. And you just can't get them because they're like, oh, well, they're trying to do good. And it's true. And a lot of the early progressives, and I'm talking about the early 1900s, started locally, and a lot of it was reform movements. And I would be argued to say that a lot of us could not say bad things about some of the reform movement. I just listed a few of them, like building codes, having fire escapes. That was a result of a terrible fire in New York City. Zoning laws. Who would be arguing against zoning laws? The idea of not having saloons and bars by schools, by, you know, elementary schools. So a lot of what they did was not terrible, what we think of today, of their ideas. However, the intellectuals, remember, I'm talking about rank and file, people who are trying to help their neighborhood. A lot of them were called progressives, and they kind of fall under that. But the intellectuals, the Herbert Crowleys, the John Deweys, the Woodrow Wilson, I throw you another name out there, Richard Ely, who was an actual minister, Richard Ely. He was about as socialist as you could get. They were, the intellectuals were socialists, and later on, a lot of them became corporatists. If you don't know what a corporatist is someone who believes that capitalism is the way to create wealth, but capitalism must be completely controlled and regulated by the federal government. That's the idea of a corporatist. Now, if you've never heard that term before, again, I'm giving the intellectual term. The guy that came up with this idea was a fellow by the name of Mussolini. Mussolini was a national socialist, opposite of Stalin, who was an international socialist. That's why Stalin hated Mussolini and called Mussolini a right-winger. That's how fascists got the phrase right-wing, was from Stalin attacking Mussolini, saying you're not a real, you know, socialist, or you're not a real communist because you're not an internationalist. You're not a real Marxist, in other words. The workers of the world idea. So Stalin is the one that labeled them right-wingers. And, of course, Mussolini didn't care. Of course, Mussolini started a political party and a whole idea called fascism. And then his understudy, who was quite a bit younger than him, Hitler, you know all about Hitler. Hitler took these ideas. But that's called corporatism. Here's your little trivia I'll throw out there. When Mussolini came up with these ideas, he was very popular in the United States. A lot of journalists like John Reed, Walter Lippmann, came out in support of him. In fact, when FDR became president, he had a cabinet official by the name of Hugh Johnson, who was the Secretary of the Interior, who actually had a portrait of Mussolini in his office. This is a president's cabinet official. Of course, now, he took it down once Mussolini started slaughtering people, once he invaded Ethiopia and started slaughtering people. But my point is this, is it was quite popular. Corporatism, socialism, these were not, you know, bugaboos back then the way they are today, which is kind of sad. It's when we really started seeing the problem was actually with the Bolshevik Revolution. Now, what are these intellectual leaders? How did they change things? They wanted a national progressive movement. They said, hey, this is working just fine. So what we need is a national progressive movement to transform America. So the next question is, what is the progressive dream? I've got a couple of quotes from Herbert Croly. This is from his book. By the way, if you want to read his book, I have read it. It was many years ago. I do not want to read it again. It is the most obtuse, hard-to-read book. The guy is a terrible writer, but if you can wade through it, good luck. I did once, and that was all I could take. But here I do have a couple of quotes from his book, Promise of American Life. One, this is their goals: to create a better society and eventually a perfect society inhabited by better and in the future perfect people. You see the utopianism right there. Here's another quote from the same book. Democracy must stand or fall on a platform of possible human perfectibility. Folks, progressives were on a mission and they are still on a mission. Now, if you think about these ideas are completely different from our founding fathers. What did our founding fathers believe? Some of the things that they did? Because the progressives reject a lot of these ideas. For instance, progressives reject the idea of federalism. Federalism is a political philosophy that our government, that our founders came up with, and the idea to protect. Now, by the way, one of the things that got me really involved in this, because I got into studying the Founding Fathers a couple of years ago, and it was a dialogue I had with one of my two progressive colleagues. We were actually at Monterey's eating some lunch, and they like to pick fights with me. I don't know how else to say it. They enjoy it. And by the way, we're not enemies. We had lunch together. We still have lunch together. But we are on diametrically opposite political worldview. Because, folks, progressivism is a worldview, okay? That's what this is. It's a worldview. It's how they see things. But we got to talking about human nature. And I made a comment. I said, well, the Founding Fathers believed in original sin because because that's why they wanted separation of powers. That's why they wanted limited government. That's why they wanted federalism. And they were like, oh, no, that's not true. That's absolutely not true. The founding fathers were creatures of the Enlightenment, and they saw everyone as having a good nature, or at the very least, tabula rasa. So that's what really got me going. And folks, I am convinced the founding fathers did believe in original sin. Most of them. I'll throw Jefferson as the exception, but he wasn't even at the Constitutional Convention. But most of them, the overwhelming numbers of founding fathers believed in original sin. But let's go on here. They did not believe in limited government or the separation of powers. They completely reject the idea of natural laws and natural rights given us by God in the Declaration of Independence. They completely reject that. They believe that all rights come from the government. They believe that all rights are not from God, they come from the government. They say that's what the Constitution is all about. Not only do they come from the Constitution, but this is what they're really big into, is they believe that the Constitution is a living document, that it changes with the times. I'll give you a quote from a very famous president. He was asked about the Constitution. Here's what he said. He said, it is a horse and buggy constitution not adequate for the automobile age. He said this is what he thought about the founders' ideas of the Constitution. His argument was, no, it's a living document. Therefore, we redefine it. Each new generation redefines the Constitution. He said it's okay to keep what it says. By the way, this first started in the 1920s is when it first started. I'm going to read a quote from a leading progressive today. And it's a little bit abstract, but I think you'll get the gist of it. Think about, he's talking about a living constitution. This is a quote. The generations that wrote and ratified the Bill of Rights and the 14th Amendment did not presume to know the extent of freedom in all of its dimensions. And so they entrusted to future generations a charter protecting the right of all persons to enjoy liberty as we learn its meaning. Now, who said that? I mean, think about that. In other words, he's saying, founding fathers, they didn't even know what rights were. They didn't know what freedom was. We redefine freedom all the time. This was said by a Supreme Court justice who wrote the majority opinion in 2015 of the Burwell case. If you don't remember the Burwell case, that is legalizing homosexual marriage. It was written by Anthony Kennedy. Anthony Kennedy is a lifelong Republican who was put on the Supreme Court by Ronald Reagan. My next point, this is a worldview, it's in both parties. There are progressives in both parties. Don't think they're not. That's Anthony Kennedy, put on there by Ronald Reagan. By the way, I will make a point. It was Reagan's third choice. The first two were pretty staunch conservatives, or what I would call an originalist thinker regarding the Constitution. They were both attacked terribly by the progressives and liberals, primarily the Democrats, who put them down, led by a senator by the name of Ted Kennedy. Of course, the first one was a guy named Robert Bork, but Kennedy was seemed to be, he was the about the only one that Reagan could get approved, because they had stonewalled for almost 2 years on Reagan's appointment. So Reagan finally just threw up his hands and said, here's Anthony Kennedy, I hope he's not as bad as I think he is. And I'm paraphrasing Reagan. But anyway, it is definitely it's a worldview. By the way, while I'm on it, I don't know what you think about taking prayer out of the schools, Bible reading out of the schools, but the person that led the fight to get those off was a Chief Justice of the Supreme Court named Earl Warren, who also was a Republican. So So it is a world, it's definitely in both parties. I will say one thing, right now it completely dominates one party. And that's, and I'm sorry if you're a Democrat, but it's the Democrat Party. It completely dominates the Democrat Party. But don't think it's not in both parties. So that is the living constitution. Oh, I forgot to show you, already seen that. That's from FDR right there. Let's go on. Let me say one other thing about the living constitution. With Antonin Scalia, we have had three Supreme Court justices who truly are originalist. Another one, John Roberts, who kind of goes back and forth, although he believes he's an originalist, although he has a little bit different take on it. Kennedy is sometimes an originalist, most of the time he's not. And on the other side, you have absolutely four who believe in the living constitution. This is now being taught to your children. If you pick up any political science book, they state it as a fact that the United States Constitution, I picked one up at TCC, it states right there the United States Constitution is a living document, subject basically to the whims. Let me close this thought on that. If you really think about it, if you believe in a living Constitution, by the way, I threw this at my colleagues and they scoffed at me and said I was crazy, but I'm used to them saying that. I said, if you believe in a living Constitution, that means it is subject to change by people. And my question is, who are those people that decide to redefine it? That would be the Supreme Court. So that would be five people would have the authority to redefine. To me, that's a tyranny. That's a tyranny of five. Yeah, absolutely. You have a tyranny of five people who completely change the Constitution to whatever fits their social purposes. I don't know if you heard President Obama when he just, I think it was yesterday, when he nominated Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court. If you haven't listened to it, go back and listen to it. One of the things that President Obama stressed was how good he would be on the Constitution because of his life experiences. Not his interpretation of the Constitution. Not is it law, is it legal, his life experiences. Well, I'm sorry, that really shouldn't have anything to do with how you interpret the Constitution, your personal life experiences. Now, back to the progressives. How do they create a better society? And this is where, and you've heard this before, through the scientific method. That's a big thing that progressives push. They like to consider themselves as people of science. You'll hear this over and over and over. Science, science, science. Experts. By the way, most of the information I'm giving you are in books written by progressives. I rarely read a conservative book on the movement. Why? When they will tell you what they believe. So I have literally, I was telling Bruce, that I have, it's about this high now, a stack of books on the progressives in my office at home, which is where I do most of my work. And most of them are written by progressives because they will tell you what they believe. And one of the things they believe is the idea of experts. Now, how do they get the experts to solve problems? Through the bureaucracy. That's why progressives are so big on the government bureaucracy, you know, like the EPA, the Department of Education. And remember, they want to nationalize everything. That's their goal. They do not like federalism. They cannot stand state and local governments making decisions. They want it to come from a national because they are the smart ones and they're the ones that's going to decide and tell you what's right and what's wrong and how to run your life. So they want a huge federal bureaucracy. They also do not like democracy, although they'll tell you they do. I actually had a professor tell me this about 30 years ago. Yes, I'm that old, when I was in college. He said, if you ever want to find out who a Marxist is just listen to them if they talk about democracy, democracy, democracy. He said, probably they're a Marxist. You know, I think that guy was right. There's a show on, if you have DirecTV, there's an entire station called Free Speech TV. Their flagship show is called Democracy Now! It's ran by a lady named Amy Goodman, which I'm sorry, she's a communist, okay? But that's all they talk about is democracy. You'll very seldom hear a progressive talk about a republic. They don't like, especially a constitutional republic. No, it's all about a democracy. And folks, that's right out of Lenin's playbook. You know, power to the people as he takes their rights away from them. Anyway, they do not like the democratic process. They do not like the House of Representatives or the senators, unless they control it, that is. So how do they do it? Through a powerful presidency. That's the idea of getting the president to get more and more and more power. We're seeing this today. Folks, it has actually been going since Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt is the one that changed the idea of the presidency as far as being more and more powerful. Theodore Roosevelt was a progressive. He was a Republican. He was not as progressive as Woodrow Wilson. Here's something else. Woodrow Wilson, who was a former college professor, sad to say he was a history professor. He has a PhD in history. He's the only president we've ever had who had a PhD. He actually wrote an entire article once, and I'm paraphrasing the title, but it's basically Democracy and Socialism. You can find that on the internet because I found it once and I downloaded it, and I read it, and it's rather interesting. And so he wrote it in like the 1880s, something like that, when he was a young college professor about, yes, socialism will work with democracy. He became president of the United States. He was more of a corporatist, though. So they want a powerful presidency. Now I want to kind of conclude with some things about why is it non-Christian? You know, I've talked about some political things, but why is it non-Christian? One of the things is right up here. We Christians believe in creation. Jesus Christ believed in creation. This is a quote from Jesus Christ. But from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. Progressives despise that idea. And in fact, they have a couple of, well, have several heroes. One of them is Darwin. Charles Darwin is absolutely one of their heroes. Most progressives are evolutionists in every sense of the word. Not just biological, but sociological. In other words, they see society as evolving into something better. So they think that humans are becoming more complete. Not just, I already said, not just biologically, but sociologically. But the early progressives, and folks, you're seeing this more today, I believe, they also had the idea in the early 1900s into the 1920s and 1930s of biologically making a better person. What they mean by better is someone smarter, someone that has less mental problems and physical problems. They actually had a name for it. It was called eugenics. E-U-G-E-N-I-C-S, eugenics. Eugenics started in Western Europe. In fact, some of the early leaders of it were Charles Darwin's nephews. They were some of the leaders. It got to America. So the idea, and by the way, one of the leaders in America was a professor, a biology professor at the University of Oklahoma back in the 1920s and 1930s. He was one of the leaders of eugenics. Eugenics was this idea that you could eventually, through biology, create a better person. One of the leaders of the American eugenics movement is this lady in the top right. Her name is Margaret Sanger. She was a nurse. You probably know quite a bit about her. If you don't, I'll just give you briefly. She is lauded today. They actually have an award given out each year called the Maggie Award. And progressives line up. They love to get this award. I think Nancy Pelosi won it. I believe she won it last year. Hillary Clinton won it a few years ago. I think President Obama won it 3 years ago. So it's a big, they have a big yearly banquet. But she was a racist, folks. She was a terrible person. She wanted to pretty much exterminate minority races. She wanted forced sterilization. She actually had a place in western Pennsylvania picked out where people who had low IQs would be sterilized and move there basically under guard to live the rest of their life. In the early 1920s, she came out with what she called her plan for peace, and that's what it was about, was sterilizing people so that they could not reproduce. She opened up a series of clinics, primarily in minority neighborhoods, to push her birth control ideas. When she was alive, they were not called this, but after she died, they were renamed Planned Parenthood. She is the founder of Planned Parenthood. And by the way, I don't know if you're aware of this, but it's one of those little secrets that everyone knows about, is today, most Planned Parenthoods are still in minority neighborhoods. I just saw this in 2014. In New York City, there were more African-American babies aborted than were born. That would make her very proud because she wanted to basically do away with the black population. It's also into theology and psychology. The guy in the middle there is Sigmund Freud. He is another icon of the progressive movement. And I'm not going to say much about him because of lack of time, but he is the one into psychoanalysis, self-esteem, self-help books, anything other than turning to God. And that's the whole idea. You find the answer within you instead of in the Word of God. And that's what Sigmund Freud's all about. Sigmund Freud was an evangelical atheist. Okay, what I mean is he's a Bill Maher type. He did not like Christianity. He did not like anyone who even talked about God. The answers are all within yourself. And of course, we know his big thing. If you have a problem in your life, it's your parents' fault. And that kind of sums up his. But folks, it is also in theology. It has been in theology. It was rather minor in theology, but it's getting more and more now. Most progressives are agnostics and atheists. Most of them are. The ones I know that I work with, I work in the liberal arts department, which is aptly named politically, but most of my colleagues are agnostics, to be honest with you. I don't know very many atheists. The last staunch atheist we had, this is true, the last staunch atheist we had in our department who was just outspoken was our religion teacher. Okay, yes, at Metro Campus, he taught religion. He retired about 3 years ago. The guy that's doing it right now is an agnostic. So if you take religion at Metro from our full-time faculty, it'll be an agnostic. But it's really gotten in theology. One of the leaders today is a fellow by the name of Jim Wallis. If you've never heard of him, he is President Obama's spiritual advisor. He goes to the White House. I don't know how often. They also have a website if you're interested. It's called progressivechristianity.org. Progressivechristianity.org. Folks, I troll this stuff, okay? Because that's how you really learn to defeat them, is you find out what they believe. One of their strongest beliefs, and remember, these people call themselves Christians, and I'm not going to judge. I don't know their hearts. I don't. But I know their works, and one of their biggest thing is the rejection of original sin. They completely reject it, and I went to that website, and I got another quote from a fellow by the name of Roger Woolsey. Roger Woolsey is a proud progressive. In fact, the name of this article, which is quite long, was A Progressive Christian's View of Sin and Sinners. Roger Woolsey, W-O-L-S-E-Y, is an ordained United Methodist minister. And let me just read what he says. Remember, this is a minister. Like the rest of creation, we humans have inherent value, but we are neither the peak nor are we necessarily the purpose of God's creative energies. It is from dust that we came, and it will be to dust that we shall return. Progressive Christians tend to contend that humans never experience any original state. that entailed a carefree, harmonious, and fully God-connected Eden. The idea of a golden age in our past is a beautiful but universal human myth. Humans have not fallen from some idealized status or state of being, and there was no literal original sin. So progressive Christians, remember they consider themselves Christians, do not believe in that. Instead, originally they believed in something called a blank slate. That's an Enlightenment term. In the fancy word is tabula rasa. Folks, I remember being taught that in psychology when I was in undergraduate school. I actually talked to one of the psychology professors about a couple of months ago, and she said it's actually moving now into that people are born good. That's the new thing that's being taught, not universally, but she said that's the future, that people are being taught. Psychologists now believe that we are born good, not with a sinful nature, but we're being born good, and we're corrupted by society. That is why there is crime. That's why there's greed. That's why there is, you know, people beating each other up. So this is very important, because this is a crux of progressive beliefs. Now, the intellectuals, when they look upon a welfare society or strict laws on your behavior, it's more than just helping the poor. It's returning you to that good nature that you were born. So it's not just about helping people that need help. It's about changing society. Remember Crowley? We want to perfect human beings. You do that by you get rid of all these problems. One of them is capitalism. Capitalism causes greed. They want what they call a cooperative economic system. The politically correct movement, that's what it's all about. And people are being duped by this. And a lot of people say, oh, I want to help people. We all want to help people. But that the intellectuals, they know what they're doing. They want total control, which, folks, is why they want the national government doing it. I don't know if you're aware of this. If you're not, you haven't been watching the news. They want to take over complete control of the education system. Complete control. They want the national government to control it. They don't like your local school board making decisions to the point of what your kids eat, right? They want the progressives to be in charge of this. So they're very, very much into these ideas. Now, folks, I want to conclude with the modern. Beginning in the 60s, a lot of things changed with progressives. One of the things that changed is, quite simply, they fell in love with sin. Most progressives now are completely for anything that is sinful. They also fell in love with a new type of philosophy. It's called postmodern philosophy. You might write that down and look it up. But it's just to sum it up, there's no such thing as absolute truth. They reject any absolute truth. They reject any type of morality. Remember the 60s and the counterculture, the hippies and the hippie wannabes. Now, if you think about it, if you compare that to Thomas Jefferson, his idea of self-evident truths, they completely reject that. There is no such thing as absolute truth. Everything is relative. They're social relativists. That's why progressives have today grabbed hold of ideas like abortion. Abortion is not just okay, but it is a right. And it's a human right. Adultery is perfectly okay. Fornication is okay. Homosexuality is okay. Because all of these, there's no such thing as truth. And if there's no such thing as truth, who are we to say what is right and wrong? And it all goes down to the idea of relativism, that things, there's no truth. I mean, that just sums it up. Of course, I threw this at my friends. There is one thing they are against, and that's greed. They want everything to be shared. Of course, they're against greed. They're against wealth. Of course, unless they're getting it, usually at the taxpayer's expense. Now the problem. Here is the problem for us. Folks, progressives control pretty much all segments of society. And this didn't happen overnight. And folks, they meant it to happen. Education. They control education, especially higher education. Especially higher education. Folks, that's why they want to nationalize education. Because there are still a lot of wonderful Christian teachers in our public schools, in elementary school, middle schools, and high school. I'm sure you know a lot of them. I know a lot, several of them. But if you get to the college level, there are few and far between. To my knowledge, unless there's somebody hiding under a rock in my department, which is liberal arts, which if you don't know what liberal arts is, that is psychology, sociology, religion, philosophy, history, political science, have I named them all? So I'm talking about quite a few professors. To my knowledge, I am the only Bible-believing Christian in the entire department. Now, there is another fella who is a good, good man who kind of has one foot in the progressive movement and one foot in the church. He goes to church all the time. He actually has a weekly Bible study at his house, but he is pro-homosexuality, he is pro-abortion. He lived with his wife for several years before they got married. You see my point. But he is about the closest I can come to saying someone else who is who actually believes the Bible. Here's a shocker, but probably the person closest to me on social issues is a Muslim lady, okay? As far as not drinking, you know, not doing all that stuff, she's pretty straight and narrow. So as far as social issues, I can talk to her easier than I can talk to just about anyone else. Not religion, but that. So it is controlled by the progressives. I'll make another point. I hear this a lot. And I have mixed feelings about it, and I understand where it's coming from, but I always hear people talk about, we have got to get rid of tenure. We've got to get rid of tenure, right? Probably some of you have said that. Be careful. If we get rid of tenure at TCC, guess who's going to probably be out the door? Right? Me. Because the progressives are in control. So getting rid of tenure might sound really good, except till you realize who is in control, especially of the colleges. I mean, it's already hard enough now. I was on a hiring committee 2 years ago, and we had over 60 applicants, and this was for This was for a humanities position. And why they put me on the committee, I don't know. But they asked, I think it's because it was summer and they couldn't find anyone else that was willing to come up there, but we had several applicants, and we had one of them that had 8 years of university teaching experience, and it wasn't me, it was somebody else put him as a possible person to interview. Well, we had two people on the committee, there were five of us, two people on the committee threw a fit. They said, we're like, what do you mean? This person has a PhD. 8 years of university teaching experience. We should at least interview this person. They said, did you not see where that person taught? And I immediately knew what they were getting at. This person had taught for 8 years at ORU, or Roberts University. They did not want anything to do. So that's kind of how they censor people. They're on the hiring committee, right? And don't think for a minute when they're not in there, they don't really ask questions to try to figure out where these people's worldview is. So education, they control it. Entertainment. I don't need to say anything else. They control entertainment. Turn on your TV, go to a movie, they completely control. Sports. You may not be aware of that, sports. But have you ever thought about this? Other than the former athletes, all of those journalists, sports journalists, have been to journalism school. They have college degrees at universities or four-year liberal arts colleges. And guess what they've been taught is progressivism. And you see it all the time, all the time. Bob Costas came out just about 6 months ago and went on a tirade about homosexual marriage in the middle of a game. In the middle of a game. I think it was a baseball game. I was so upset at him. But he just went on a rant about homosexual marriage during a sporting event. Of course, politics, I'm already going to say, I've already made that clear, it's in both parties. Again, I'll emphasize, it completely dominates one party today. It used to not. It completely dominates that party today, but don't think for a minute that it's not in the other one. How can you tell if someone's a progressive, if they're a politician? Listen for key words. If they talk about social justice or economic justice, any type of justice, or if they talk about fairness, or if they talk about rights, you know, like the right to kill the unborn, or if they talk about equality, they'll talk about marriage equality. By the way, I don't have time to go into it, but I'd be glad to talk to you afterwards. One of the big things that progressives are into, when they talk about rights, they hate negative rights. They're into positive rights. Negative rights is the Bill of Rights. It tells the government what they cannot do, right? Positive rights are by the government what they do for you, like the right to health care, right? The right, that's a positive right. In other words, the government must supply it to you. That's an example of a positive right. So I'm going to finish with a couple of things here. It's something you need to understand, and I'm going to be honest with you. Most conservative, original, traditional thinkers look at progressives, and we think of them as stupid. We do. We think of them as stupid. A good example of this is in the New York Times, in the top cover, it had an article about prison population went up. This was about 3 years ago. On the bottom cover, it had another article. It said, crime rate in New York goes down. Now, if you're a more conservative, you think, wow, there's a corollary there, right? But if you're a progressive thinker, all you do is you read the top article and you go on a rant. Oh my goodness, we're putting too many people in prison. What can we do about that? We have got to start letting people out of prison. Again, we think, we're like, wow, that's kind of stupid. There's a correlation there. But here's the opposite. And folks, I face that, and you probably have too. It's something you need to be aware of. They don't think you're stupid. They think you're evil. Progressives see their enemies as evil. They see this as a war. And a lot of conservative traditional thinkers don't understand that, especially our people in Washington. I mean, they're so busy trying to get along, they don't understand that they're in a war of ideas, because this is a worldview. So what do we do? How do we fight back? One, know what you believe. Folks, you must understand what you believe. Theologically, politically, philosophically, excuse me. Know what you believe, know what they believe. I just said the second one, didn't I? Know what they believe. Do you know what they truly believe? After tonight, I hope you'll know a little bit more. Thirdly, arm your children and grandchildren. Folks, they are inundated by this. TV, movies, school, textbooks. Have you ever read your kids' or your grandkids' textbooks? Pick them up and start looking. It will shock you. I'll be up front. I no longer use a textbook in my history class. I don't. I tell them everything they need to know. I tell them. You say, well, that's, you're brainwashing them. I can't find a textbook that is approved by the state that I can use, because all of them are so liberally or progressively slanted. So I have quit using them. I do have them read it's called a monograph. A monograph is on a specific topic. I have them read something, and they do two book reviews on a monograph. But I post lectures on the internet, on the website. And so I've quit using a textbook. Some of my students, they have to have a textbook. So I say, yeah, go ahead and get a textbook, but you don't need it for this class. That's how it's gotten with me, that I no longer trust the textbooks. And it's real easy. Anytime I get textbooks, I have a stack of them in my office, because the textbook people are always trying to sell me textbooks. So I just stack them at my office. But it's real. All I do is I pick one up, and I go to the Founding Fathers, and I read stuff there, and it usually is always liberally slanted. And then the second place I go is I go to the chapter on Ronald Reagan, and invariably it depicts Ronald Reagan as an evil person who all but destroyed the United States because he was so radical. And I'm not going to have my kids read that stuff. So I don't do away with it. So, but arm your kids. Make sure they understand. But you got to do it in a certain way. Fourthly, don't be discouraged or defeatist. Okay? Don't be discouraged. Look there. Christ is on our side. Let's don't forget that. We win in the end. I know it sounds scary. We win in the end. When I say it sounds scary, I mean what's happening today. Folks, Christ is our hope. Fifthly, pray and lovingly counsel your progressive friends. I rarely get into heated arguments with people at my job. You notice I said rarely? It has happened. But rarely. You know, unless they start calling me names, which I have been called names. I mean, I've got she's not a friend. There's a professor in at my school, and I'll just be honest with you, I avoid her because she is just so mean-spirited towards me. And I'll never forget, we are required to go to graduation, which is fine. We go to graduation, we have to put on our monkey suit, and you know, the kids like us being there, but last year I walked in, I was, as normal, I was almost late. So they were already lined up to march in, and I walked in, and I tried to get in line with some people I knew, and right in front of everybody, out of her mouth, she goes, "Well, there's Mr. Straight and Narrow. Here he comes. He's one of the Bible believers." Yeah, just kind of shouted it out, and I said, "I'm guilty." So I just got in line, and that's all I said to her, was, "I'm guilty," which was okay. And I got in line. I'll be honest with you, I got in line next to the Muslim girl. She's about the only one I can talk to about certain things, but not about religion. But that's another topic. But I just want to conclude with this. Those five things I talked are so important, and I know I'm talking to the choir, but we have got to start standing. We have got to stand, or we're going to lose our country. I am so concerned about this election in 2016 and the ramifications it's going to have on the Supreme Court. It is kind of scary. But regardless of what happens, we have to stand, and as long as we can, fight for our Christian freedom. There may be a time when fighting for our Christian freedom ends us up being fined or losing a job. I may lose my job someday. I don't know. I've always talked about teaching till I'm 70, which is a long ways off. I may look old, but it's a long ways off. But I've always talked about it. I may not be able to. I don't know what the future holds, because I believe that persecution is getting closer and closer. We're already seeing snippets of it, you know, like bakeries and photographers But it could happen with ministers. It absolutely could. And don't think for a minute that our enemies, because they see us as evil, will not try to pick a fight. They absolutely do that. So we've got to stand. Because, folks, if we don't stand now, the question is, when are we going to stand? We've got to stand, but we've got to do it through Christ. We've got to do it with a loving attitude. And I know sometimes that's hard, and I'm preaching to myself. Sometimes I have lost my temper. I'll be up front with you. Last time was with the religion teacher, and I won't say what happened, but it was not pretty. The good news is he was smaller than me. And I'll turn it over to Jim now.